Welcome to the Book Nook on WYSO. I'm Vic McCunis, and I'd like to welcome to the program today Daniel Stashower. He joins us by telephone from Maryland. Welcome to the program, sir.
Thank you.
You have a book that's just coming out about a very interesting assassination plot, and it's one that I was not aware of. How did you come upon this story?
It's a terrifically interesting little chapter from the days leading up to the Civil War. In 1861, Lincoln had been elected president, and the effect of the elections had been polarizing, as of course you'll realize. We still see a lot of political division today, but this was on a different scale. And as Lincoln's inauguration drew near, seven states had seceded from the Union, and we really were drawing to the brink of war. And over a period of 13 days, as Lincoln traveled by train from his home in Springfield, Illinois, to Washington, D.C. for his inauguration, the air was just absolutely filled with rumors of an assassination plot.
And the result is a book called The Hour of Peril, The Secret Plot to Murder Lincoln Before the Civil War. Baltimore was the bad place, wasn't it? That's the place where all the trouble was expected.
Well, that's where this particular aspect of the plot was focused. And yeah, you're right. Baltimore had a reputation, a serious reputation for violence at this time. You know, we hear a lot of talk about the gangs of New York during this period, but Baltimore also had an entrenched gang warfare. But it was all then and now, it was a very important city. It was the center of shipping and an arrival point for huge numbers of immigrants. It still is. My wife was sworn in as a citizen in Baltimore. But at the time of Lincoln's election, the city was known as Mob Town. There were clashing cultures, clashing ethnicities, clashing of political leanings. One newspaper said that on election day, the gutters flowed with rivers of blood.
We also have the story of the Pinkerton Detective Agency. And this is fascinating to read how this all came about.
Well, that's what drew me to the story. Alan Pinkerton is a fascinating character. He's a tough nut. He was scrappy, grizzled, quick to anger. And it's a very American story. He was born in Scotland. He got into trouble with the law, and he came to America as a cooper, a barrel maker. And it looks like he's going to go on quietly making barrels for the rest of his life. But one day he's out cutting wood for barrel staves, and he stumbles across a group of counterfeiters. They're dividing their ill-gotten spoils around a campfire. And the next day, he leads the local sheriff on a raid and rounds them up. And the next thing you know, Pinkerton is the sheriff. And soon after that, he becomes something that was new in this country at that time, a private detective. And his logo was a stern, unblinking eye glaring out over the words, "We never sleep." And soon that logo, the eyeball staring out, gives us the phrase, private eye.
Oh. It's just fascinating to read his history because he was learning on the job. He was basically inventing it as he went along, and you have a really wonderful anecdote about this first counterfeiter that he's trying to arrest. He's trying to catch red-handed, and this guy really put on a clinic. He really taught Pinkerton some tricks, didn't he?
Well, that's exactly right. This happened soon after he and the sheriff had broken up the counterfeiting ring. At the time, counterfeiting was a huge, huge problem in America because individual banks printed up their own currency, and a lot of it was easily duplicated, especially in the Illinois area where Pinkerton was living at that time. And this town where he was living was frequently there would be just waves of counterfeit notes. And a shopkeeper comes to Pinkerton and he says, "Listen, can you help us out? You did a pretty good job with these counterfeiters. We know that if you put your mind to it, you'll be able to help us here." And Pinkerton thinks about it, and he later wrote, he realized he was at a crossroads in his life, because here he is. He's barefoot. He's not even wearing a shirt. And here this shopkeeper is asking him to ride to the rescue to match wits with this seasoned, polished, experienced blackmailer. And Pinkerton realized he was in over his head. But in a way, as you say, he was learning on the job. He was able to turn this to his advantage, because it turned out that the counterfeiter felt, well, here's a greenhorn. I can lead this guy by the nose. And Pinkerton played along, and at the critical moment was able to turn the tables.
Daniel Stashower joins us. His new book is The Hour of Peril. As Pinkerton developed his agency in Chicago, he hired a number of very talented people, and one of his greatest hires was a woman, and she became a crucial part of his agency, didn't she?
She absolutely did. Her name was Kate Warren, and this really is my favorite thing in the book. One day, it's 1856, Pinkerton is sitting at his desk, and there's a knock at the door, and he looks up, and there's a young woman standing there, and she introduces herself as Kate Warren. She's a widow. She's 22 or 23 years old, and she's looking for work. And Pinkerton, understandably, assumes that she is talking about secretarial work. It's 1856. Susan B. Anthony is barely out of the starting gate. But she looks at Pinkerton, and she says, I have come to inquire as to whether you would not employ me as a detective. And Pinkerton is absolutely startled. But to his credit, he gives her a fair hearing. He says, it's not the custom to employ women as detectives. How exactly do you propose to be of service? And she's ready for this. And she says, a female detective may go and worm out secrets in ways that are impossible for male detectives. She goes on to explain that a man will hide all traces of his guilt from other men, but he will tell his wife. And if Pinkerton can put a woman into the equation who can win the confidence of that wife or that girlfriend, she will eventually find out what's going on. And that's exactly what she did.
Okay, so Abraham Lincoln has been elected president. The Union is falling apart, and he's coming to Washington to be inaugurated on this train from Springfield, Illinois. And along the way, he stops all over the place to give speeches. This is an amazing spectacle to even imagine.
That's absolutely right. And it has to be pointed out that in 1861, there was just no easy way to get from Springfield to Washington. America's railroads were expanding at a fantastic rate, but there was no single direct line. The railroad system looked like a game of pickup sticks. And Lincoln had to travel across this zigzag route of independent regional lines. And this involved making a lot of transfers, going from one station to the next. There are stories of members of his entourage having to carry their own baggage across town as they went from train station to train station. And he wound up traveling this crisscrossing route over 2,000 miles on 18 different railroad lines. But that's just the logistical element. There was also this political element to the journey, which was even more complicated. By the time Lincoln set off, there were 7 states that had already seceded, and he hoped that he could use the train journey to visit state capitals and legislators in the North, but also to give speeches that would offer calming words and a hand of reconciliation to the South. He said that he hoped that when we shall become better acquainted, we shall like each other the more. And this is a very modern idea, but he was working the crowds, trying to put his ideas across, and he gave over 100 speeches.
The book is The Hour of Peril. Daniel Stashower wrote it, and he's going to be in our area on Tuesday night, February 5th. He will be at Books & Company in Beaver Creek for a book signing that evening. And this book... It's kind of an unusual book for the imprint, isn't it, Minotaur? They've never put out a book like this, have they?
Well, it's their first nonfiction book. And all the people that I've been working with there were very enthusiastic about doing narrative nonfiction of this type, and they've been terrifically supportive, and I look forward to doing more books of this type with them.
And, of course, you are a crime fiction guy.
Well, I've done mystery fiction and nonfiction. I sort of work both sides of the fence.
I remember your book, The Beautiful Cigar Girl.
Oh, thank you. That was my most recent nonfiction book, and that was a story like this one. It was centered on a major crime that was considered sort of the crime of the century in New York at that time, and how Edgar Allan Poe attempted to weigh in and solve it in a way that would reopen the investigation.
These are very Baltimore-centric books, aren't they?
Well, yeah. Poe, of course, so there are a lot of cities that claim him. Baltimore is only one. He also spent a lot of time in Richmond, of course, and New York, and all over the place. And for that particular story, the crime took place in New York, and Poe also had drew on his experiences of that city.
Your publisher sent me a press packet, and one of the inserts is what's apparently a fake newspaper, the Baltimore Sun, and the headline reads, "Lincoln Killed in Baltimore."
It's wonderful, isn't it?
It is.
But it does give you a stark picture of what might have happened if things had played out a little differently during this critical 13-day period as Lincoln was trying to make his way to Washington for his inaugural.
And as this period is transpiring, Pinkerton's detectives are out there trying to figure out what's going on. And you follow these detectives. You show us where they are and the information that they're obtaining and how they're getting it. And it's very interesting to read how they were able to infiltrate some of these groups.
They also came in for a lot of criticism for that afterwards. This wasn't the way Pinkerton usually did business. When he was first describing how he was going to approach this, he said, you know, our usual method is very slow, he said. It's even tedious. We work very slowly, and by tiny incremental degrees, we work our way into the confidence of the wrongdoers until we're ready to spring our trap. But in this case, the clock was ticking. By the time he got to work, Lincoln's schedule was set. And at a certain point, the train was on the way. Lincoln was literally on the way on the train, and he had to figure out what was going on and get it sorted out before the train arrived. And so they had to work very quickly. He came to Baltimore with a large team of people, and they spread about town basically saying, you know, we're in sympathy with your Southern ideals. Whatever you have to say, we're listening. And Pinkerton even made a sort of pledge of money to a man who had an office next to his, saying, use this as you see fit in the support of Southern ideals.
And one of these conspirators that they met, who's in the book quite a bit, is a guy named James Luckett. And by an odd coincidence, I have a friend with that exact same name. And I saw him and I said, I just read about one of your ancestors. He's got to be related to you.
You know, it's funny. Pinkerton asked that James Luckett's name be stricken from his official records because in spite of the fact that he considered James Luckett to be a conspiracy, part of this conspiracy, he was certainly a Southern sympathizer and very much in favor of Maryland secession. Pinkerton liked the guy. They had spent some time together in Baltimore. Pinkerton came to consider him not only a friend, but a very decent man. And he said, I would like to see his name taken out of my official records because I think he suffered badly in the war, and I would hate to see him suffer any further grievance because of any writings of mine.
Daniel Stashower joins us. His new book is The Hour of Peril. What was it like doing the research?
So it was a lot of fun. There's been a tremendous amount written about Lincoln, of course, and some written about Pinkerton. But what I enjoyed was going back to the newspaper accounts at the time as the story was unfolding. And you got a tremendous number of different perspectives, particularly in Baltimore, where the Baltimore Sun was urging civility. When Lincoln arrived, Lincoln was scheduled to come and give a speech in Baltimore on a particular Sunday afternoon. And the Baltimore Sun, you can read it in several days' worth of editions leading up to it, was saying, listen, we don't agree with him, but let's not besmirch the fair fame of Baltimore by countenancing any trouble.
Well, I must say I was surprised when I found out how Lincoln made it through Baltimore. And I don't know if you even want to talk about that, but it's a pretty amazing story.
Well, certainly anybody who reads this book, it would be a very unusual reader who didn't realize that Lincoln survives and goes on to become president of the United States. But it was very, very touch and go behind the scenes as to whether he would acknowledge that there was a problem. That was the second big job that was facing Pinkerton at the time. He was racing the clock because it wasn't enough that there were simply rumors that there was a plot forming against Lincoln. He had to get something concrete, something absolutely indisputable, because Lincoln was refusing to acknowledge that there was danger. It was not in his political interest to acknowledge that there was a plot. Mm. So Pinkerton had two problems. One was to uncover the conspiracy. The other was to persuade Lincoln to take action, to do something about it. And in the end, Lincoln needed more proof than Pinkerton was able to provide before he decided to take the measures that he did. He had independent verification that came to him through his own designated Secretary of State, William Seward.
Do you think that Seward's son's message was the thing that made the difference in the end?
Lincoln said afterwards that the fact that what Seward was saying seemed to confirm what Pinkerton was saying weighed heavily in making the decision that he did. But it should be pointed out that Lincoln, you know, who was a lawyer after all, questioned Frederick Seward very carefully about where he got the information, because he wasn't going to put any stock in it if he had just heard it from Pinkerton or one of Pinkerton's men or women, as the case may be. He needed to know that what Seward was hearing, the message that was being relayed from William Seward through his son Frederick, had come from independent sources. And it did, and that weighed very heavily with Lincoln in making his decision. Very important, to recognize, speaking of Frederick Seward, that the whole idea that something bad could happen to an American politician, particularly a president or a president-elect in this case, was something that people really hadn't thought very much about. It hadn't happened. And Frederick Seward said, the time had not yet come when Americans in general could realize that a crime at once so nefarious and so foolish as the assassination of the chief magistrate was possible. And it's all the more remarkable that Frederick Seward would say something about this, because you'll recall that when his father, Secretary of State William Seward, was attacked on the night of the Lincoln assassination, Fred Seward, his son, got his skull fractured trying to protect his father. So he had learned all too vividly that such a thing was possible.
What a horrible irony. Yeah. And then, of course, the next 50 years, suddenly assassination was in vogue, wasn't it?
Well, that is the thing. What's the first thing you think of when I say presidential motorcade? Well, you think of JFK, you think of Dallas, because we do have a long and tragic history. But this just wasn't the case when Lincoln was coming to the White House.
Yeah.
One New York newspaper said, assassination is not congenial to the American character. Well, you know, it's still not. We don't kid ourselves, but we know it can happen.
Well, I think of Mayor Cermak before I think of John Connolly myself. But my guest is Daniel Stashower. His book is The Hour of Peril, and he will be at Books & Company on Tuesday night, February 5th in Beaver Creek for a book signing for this book, which is just coming out. And I heard a rumor you might be from Ohio yourself.
I am indeed. I grew up in Cleveland. I still have family there, and although maybe I shouldn't say it, still root for the Browns and the Indians.
Very good. I think one of the most interesting parts of this whole story is that when the train that Lincoln was supposed to be on comes through Baltimore, Mary Todd Lincoln, his wife, is on the train, and you have this bizarre situation where these guys come into her compartment.
Lincoln took a lot of criticism about that afterwards. He took a great deal of criticism about the whole episode, but that aspect of it in particular, and there was one Baltimore newspaper who, in writing about the fact that apparently Mrs. Lincoln had come through Baltimore as scheduled, and this newspaper writer said, so there is to be some pluck in the White House after all, even if it is beneath skirts. But there again, sources of the time conflict about what actually happened. And there is considerable evidence to show that while some of the members of Lincoln's party did proceed to the Baltimore train station as scheduled, there's some evidence to suggest that Mrs. Lincoln was taken off the train earlier, entertained at the home of a local Baltimore businessman, and then taken across town and put on the second leg of the train to continue on to Washington.
And the scene when that train pulled into the station, they weren't in control of this mob, were they?
No, they were not. And this, too, is an aspect of the story that is open to a great deal of debate. Some have said that the chief of police in Baltimore, a man named Kane, was actually actively conspiring with the conspirators because he had indicated that he really didn't see the need for a heavy police presence. He said, well, you know, we'll have police, but he didn't see the need for a heavy police presence. And Pinkerton and many others took this as a sign that he actually was in on the plot. But if Kane actually had this plan in place already to make sure that Mrs. Lincoln and perhaps Lincoln himself were not on the train, then it's possible to interpret those facts differently.
Well, this really gives a whole different aspect of Lincoln, and a lot of historians consider Lincoln to be our greatest president. And we have some wonderful examples of Lincoln giving speeches along the road here, and what an amazing speech maker he was.
It was incredible. And in a way, he considered this train journey to be something of a rolling workshop because he was very, very concerned and had spent a lot of time and attention working on his first inaugural address, the address that he would give on March 4th when he took the oath of office. And along the way, now and then, he would sort of test out sections of it, see how they landed on the ear, and give people a little bit of a preview. But the other thing that was extraordinary about all these talks he was giving is what an open-door policy he took. He wanted people to have access to him. He made a point all the way along the journey of staying in public hotels rather than in private homes so that people could come and see him and shake his hands. And he would, when he checked into a hotel, he would plant himself in one spot, and they would hold what they called a handshaking levee.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a receiving line, and it covered several city blocks. And if you wanted to shake Lincoln's hand, you got in line out in the street, and you'd be carried along as the line snaked through the open doors of the hotel, and you'd go up a flight of stairs and eventually you'd be carried along to where Lincoln was standing, and you'd shake his hand, and then you'd sort of get swept away in this tidal pull of this flow of people down an opposite set of stairs and back out onto the street. And Lincoln did this again and again with thousands of people shaking his hand like a pump handle.
Hard to imagine.
It's hard to imagine today, but that's he was very, very serious about when he said, and I'll get this wrong, but it was, "I suppose I am public property now."
Hmm. The book is The Hour of Peril, The Secret Plot to Murder Lincoln Before the Civil War. Daniel Stashower wrote it. The first time they tried to kill Lincoln, the untold story of the Baltimore plot of 1861, just published by Minotaur Books. And he's going to be in our area for a book signing. He'll be at Books and Company on Tuesday, February 5th in Beaver Creek. And I believe that's at 7 o'clock in the evening if you'd like to meet him. How did this project come about? How did you decide to write this book?
Well, you know, I've always been a huge Sherlock Holmes fan, and my first nonfiction book was about Arthur Conan Doyle, a biography of Arthur Conan Doyle. So when I was growing up, I remember reading in a book called The Valley of Fear about the Pinkertons, the Pinkerton detectives. And I think somebody says in The Valley of Fear, if there's a Pinkerton man mixed up in this business, he'll get to the bottom of it.
Hmm.
Well, that just stuck with me, and as I got older and began to read about the Pinkertons, I was fascinated, and also sort of come to find out that there's been sort of a deep misunderstanding over the years of who Pinkerton was and what he did. The Pinkertons have sort of passed into infamy as strike breakers, you know, at tools of the robber barons. But Pinkerton himself started out his career marching with labor rights movements in his native Scotland, and he ran a station on the Underground Railroad, helping runaway slaves work their way north to freedom. There were sides to him that really have not been talked about, have not been remembered, because of the things that happened in his name and later on under the auspices of his National Detective Agency.
Well, we really appreciate your time today.
It's been a pleasure. Thanks so much.
You've been listening to The Book Nook. My guest has been Daniel Stashower. His book is The Hour of Peril, The Secret Plot to Murder Lincoln Before the Civil War. For The Book Nook, I'm Vic McInnes. Thanks for listening. There was a bit of an uproar a couple of years ago when Ian Rankin's beloved Detective Inspector John Rebus retired from the police force in Edinburgh, Scotland. That was the end of the series. But wait, John Rebus is back. He's retired and he's solving crimes again in a new novel, Standing in Another Man's Grave. Ian Rankin returns to the program next week in The Book Nook. The Book Nook is recorded at Soundspace in Yellow Springs and engineered by Chris Hertzler.